Today on the Afternoon Magazine, I'll explore the source of Shakespeare's imagination. I'm talking with a cultural critic to reveal the true Shakespeare, and he moves beyond the stale debate about who wrote the plays to instead help us rethink the greatest works of human imagination. I'm Bill Hammack. Join me by calling 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Let's welcome to the Afternoon Magazine Ron Rosenbaum.
Thanks, Bill. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Well, Ron, in 1970, you saw a production of A Midsummer's Night Dream, and you claimed that that changed your life forever. How did it change you and start you on this journey toward interpreting and reading Shakespeare?
Well, you know, I was a graduate student at Yale, and I'd studied literature, and I'd studied and read Shakespeare, but nothing ever affected me as much as seeing this one legendary production of A Midsummer Night's Dream. And I say legendary because it's really changed not just my life, but the life of a huge number of actors, directors, people, ordinary people who have seen it. We're like almost a forlorn secret society mm-hmm. who have seen this amazing production and have ever since been looking for something to live up to it or to something to equal it. And what was it about it? It was almost as if you were seeing the original source of Shakespeare's genius. It was almost as if you were there the first night back in 1595 when Midsummer Night's Dream was first played and the words were first uttered. I have to say, it was electrifying. And what it did was it sent me back to reading Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. It sent me back to the words on the page and with a different set of eyes, with a set of eyes that had been opened up by seeing the potential of great Shakespeare on stage. And so I began a cycle, and that's why I say it changed my life. I've really devoted a lot of time in my life to reading and rereading cycle after cycle of Shakespeare's plays and never finding a point where they cease amazing me or taking me deeper into some realm of wonder.
Now, you know, you mentioned taking you through a well of wonder and that they get deeper and deeper. Throughout the book, you use the word bottomless in describing Shakespeare. And you were hinting at it here a little bit, but what exactly do you mean by bottomlessness?
Well, I mean that, you know, when I read other great poets, say, like Keats, a favorite of mine, I can read Keats' Odes to Autumn, or et cetera, over and over again to a certain point. And at a certain point, I feel like, well, they're not continuing to give me back what they did when I the first five or six times I read them. But with Shakespeare's plays, they continue to give me back new insights. There are new echoes, new resonance, new links to other plays, new pleasurable connections made, new senses of meaning and theme, and there's something very amazing and mysterious and pleasurable about that I don't find in other literature, except perhaps from one or two novels of Vladimir Nabokov.
Which novels would those be, though?
Well, certainly Pale Fire. That mm-hmm. is, for me, like the great novel of the past century. To right. a lesser extent, Lolita. It's, of course, a more problematic novel.
But. Well, Pale Fire is an interesting choice for you because you really look deeply at the text in here, and Pale Fire is a book where much of it is in footnotes.
Pale Fire is,
There's an academicness to it.
On the surface, at least, although it's a hilarious, pleasurable novel to read. It begins with a 1,000-line poem, and the novel takes the form of footnotes by a madman professor. And do I feel some sense of identification with him? I suppose I do. But, you know, and I suppose my book, The Shakespeare Wars, in some way is, my doing a Pale Fire job on Shakespeare, my examining all the possible ways of looking and deepening the pleasures of Shakespeare by getting deep into the literally the scholarly wars over how to interpret Shakespeare.
Well, so when you're looking then at the bottomlessness here, you're really looking for the thing that makes Shakespeare unique, although you admit this is something of a slippery concept, but there may be something irreducible there. That's the bottomlessness.
Yes. In other words, you know, I mean, it's possible that, you know, at a certain point, I'll read Troilus and Cressida for the 20th time, and it'll stop repaying attention in the way it has before, and maybe I'll last it, but I have a feeling that with Shakespeare, it's going to outlast me. I won't live long enough to outlast it. I won't live long enough to get to the bottom of it. There will still be echoes from the well, so to speak, that continue to fascinate and excite me. And I guess, in some way, what I was trying to do to bring to the reader in the Shakespeare Wars is some of that excitement and some of the arguments over how to access that bottomlessness. And the arguments are conducted not just among scholars, but also among directors who I consider in some way the truest scholars of Shakespeare.
Well, let's take a look then at a couple of ways that you probe Shakespeare in the book. And one thing is that if you look very carefully at the words in the plays to find their exact meaning, they slide around in the sense that Shakespeare's plays exist in multiple versions. Can you give us a sense of some of the variations in the plays?
Yes. This is one of the greatest wars in all the Shakespeare wars that I cover, and it's a war over the fact, it's really a war over what kind of writer Shakespeare was and how that explains the variations. Was he Shakespeare, the one-draft wonder of Shakespeare in Love, a guy who would dash off plays for the playhouse, send them off to the playhouse, and go back, as we saw in Shakespeare in Love, to rolling around in bed with Gwyneth Paltrow and forget about it? Or was he a much more careful, serious reviser of his own work who would go back to his first drafts and subtly change them in subtle ways, change them in big ways? And the example that I focus most closely on in the Shakespeare Wars is the example of King Lear's dying words. We have two versions of King Lear, an early 1608 version and a later posthumous 1623 version. The question is, did Shakespeare, there are many differences, did Shakespeare revise it? Certainly, the key difference may be in how Lear dies. And if you remember, Lear is crouching over, it's a terrible, terrible moment, critic Stephen Booth calls the end of King Lear the five most terrifying moments in all of literature. But if you remember, at the end, Cordelia, King Lear's daughter, has been hanged. He's crouching over her dead body. He's holding a feather up to her lips, hoping that he'll see a sign of life, that the feather will stir with the breath of life. And in the earlier 1608 version, he sees no sign of life. And he cries out this self-annihilating cry, "Break, heart, I prithee, break." And then he dies. That's it. Utterly bleak. However, in the second version of King Lear, someone, and was it Shakespeare, was it someone else, has changed King Lear's dying words. He no longer says, "Break, heart, I prithee, break," and dies. Those words are reassigned to another actor a little later on. Instead, King Lear's dying words are, in a way, some of the most beautiful, the most Shakespearean words in all of Shakespeare. He seems to be looking at her lips and seeing something stir the feather, perhaps her breath, perhaps she lives. And then he says, "Do you see this? Look on her. Look her lips. Look there. Look there." Of course, I'm not a great actor. This is my version of it. But in any case, what it suggests is that Lear then dies. Those are his last words. But he dies with a vision that she lives, that she's still living. He has this final moment of communion between his daughter, whom he thought was dead, and himself. And it really gives a wholly different tone, note, coloration to the ending of the play, a much more redemptive one than the bleak earlier one. It suggests that maybe there is at least a little bit of recompense for all the suffering that Lear has gone through. Maybe there's a little bit of redemption. On the other hand, some people have interpreted that new ending as perhaps even bleaker. It may be a sign of Lear's madness recurring again, that his poor addled brain is just imagining that she lives, and so it's even bleaker than the original bleak ending. But it certainly raises questions about, you know, everyone talks about King Lear as if they know what it means, or, you know, this is Lear-like, that's Lear-like, and yet a real civil war has broken out for the past three decades among Shakespeare scholars over whether Shakespeare went back to the earlier version and said, I can't leave it, Lear dying like this. This is the bleakest thing in the world. People will go out and slit their wrists. Maybe I'll add something that will suggest a possible note of uplift as he dies. And so, anyway, that's an example of why some of these variations are both fascinating and also contentious.
Well, let's take a look then at how scholars look at these variations. I mean, you mentioned a change to Lear here, and we don't know if that's Shakespeare or prompt copies or actors' memories. Could you contrast the approaches of two scholars, two editors in your book? You mentioned Harold Jenkins and then the New Arden general editor, Ann Thompson. They were both... particularly Jenkins was creating a definitive text of Hamlet, and Thompson had
yes.
a different approach. Could you contrast those two approaches?
Sure. Yeah, it's fascinating because in a way it shows how Shakespeare textual editors are really exciting, interesting characters, so Shakespearean characters all their own in a way. And Harold Jenkins I met when he was 90 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He had spent 30 years preparing his edition of Hamlet. And what a Hamlet editor has to do, it's almost like a priest-like vocation. A Hamlet editor has to take the three early versions of Hamlet, the so-called bad quarto, the so-called good quarto, and the folio version. And there are variations among all of them. And for centuries, the role of the Hamlet editor was to pick and choose from each and to conflate them, to mush them together into one version, and there are lines that are in one version but not in the other version. The pales and forts of reason. Denmark's a prison. Nothing is either good or bad, but thinking makes it so.
Mm-hmm.
Each of these phrases, their famous Hamlet phrases, are in one version but not the other. So, how do you choose? Well, Harold Jenkins. I met him when he was 90. Had spent 30 years. Picking and choosing, and you know, you're driving himself crazy in the effort to decide what belonged in Hamlet and what didn't. And then along comes his edition is published in 1982, 600 mm-hmm. pages long, about 400 pages of footnotes. You know, wonderful scholarly work. But 10 years or 15 years later, the Arden edition commissions a brilliant woman, Ann Thompson, to do their next version of Hamlet, their next edition, the third Arden Hamlet.
Well, let's emphasize that Jenkins was aiming for what I'll call a single monolithic definitive text.
Yes,
is that a fair...
I call it the Grand Unification Hamlet.
Okay, the Grand Unification. So
yeah.
Then along, Arden hires a new editor, Ann Thompson, and she comes along and...
And she looks at the three early texts and says, you know, there's no real way of saying that one is better than the other, one is superior to the other. You know, some people say the later folio version was modified by Shakespeare for the theater, and Shakespeare was a man of the theater, and therefore that is the preferred one because that's the more theatrical text. Others argue that, no, Shakespeare was a more literary artist, and the longer, wordier, good quarto version was the one that he most favored. Maybe he had to cut it for the theater, but he didn't want to, et cetera, et cetera. But what Ann Thompson said finally was, well, look, Harold Jenkins did the best one ever could do in trying to unify it. But really, maybe it's a mistake to try to unify these versions of Hamlet. Maybe what we should do is give the reader all three versions, let them experience all three versions of Hamlet, and experience the differences in reading it, experience the differences on stage. Let's not try to mix and match, make some patchwork quilt out of it. Let's see what it's like just to allow the reader to experience them. And maybe Shakespeare did two versions for different purposes. Maybe he did one version for literary posterity, the earlier good quarto version, the longer, wordier one. And maybe he made the later one for, you know, to make it expedient for the stage, because he's cut out, for instance, one 35-line-long soliloquy. Hamlet's final soliloquy is missing from the later folio version. And some say, well, it's a brilliant choice, and it makes it move faster, and that's really good. But do we want a Hamlet that's like an action hero Hamlet? Or maybe we want that 35-line soliloquy in there because it's Hamlet's final reflections on his own consciousness and self-consciousness, and what is Hamlet except a creature of self-consciousness? So it should be there. So instead of choosing, Ann Thompson said, "Well, let's have all three versions." And I thought it was like a great act of scholarly humility, rather than saying, this belongs in and this belongs out, and mm-hmm. you, the reader, don't deserve a part in choosing.
So if we pick up the New Art in Shakespeare, do we actually find the play three times, or do we find a lot
yes,
of footnotes?
Yes, you do.
You do.
You, you will find the first, the way it is now, there's a soft cover version of the so-called good quarto, the 1604 good quarto, then there's a hardcover version that contains the 1603 bad quarto, which is a sort of truncated, mangled version. No one's quite sure whether it was a record of a performance or someone's memory of a performance or whatever. And in that hardcover volume, you also find a third version, which is the 1623 folio version. So, you know, if you buy the complete Arden third edition of Hamlet, you'll be getting three Hamlets.
But Ron, it's true that most readers of the plays would rely on editors to lay down what is Shakespearean, yet you reject really a blind acceptance of this and encourage readers to understand the variations of the text. But how do these variants take readers closer to the bottomlessness, as you call it, of Shakespeare?
Well, I think that, you know, for instance, you know, one of the phrases that's left, well, I mean, I think the example of the dying words of King Lear certainly, you know, lead you into this, you know, difficult, it makes you consider much more deeply how Lear dies and what it means. But consider one phrase from Hamlet, say, nothing is either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Now, that's in the latest or the later folio version. And when you think about it, that's a really profound statement. Nothing is either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Basically, that's saying there's no such thing as an objective morality. There's no such thing really as an objective reality. Nothing is either good or bad. Nothing has an objective quality except the way you think about it. Now, for Shakespeare to add a profound statement like that to Hamlet makes us think much more deeply about what does that mean for the meaning of Hamlet? Mm-hmm. And what does it mean in the earlier version that it's not there? And so when I talk about bottomlessness, the variations sort of lead you in a way into a kind of Alice in Wonderland rabbit's hole of thinking about Shakespeare's words and his choices and how his mind worked. And really, that's what the Shakespeare Wars is about, how you get closer and deeper into the language. I mean, there are, you know, it's not just in textual ways either. I mean, one of the exemplary wars I examine is over a slight, delicate pause. I found a just fascinating argument when I had dinner with Sir Peter Hall, who was the founder of the Royal Shakespeare Company, which is the most influential Shakespeare company of actors and directors in the past century. It was founded in 1960. It's still going. It's based in Stratford-on-Avon. And Sir Peter was telling me how, after he had about a bottle of wine, he was pounding the table in a fury, pounding to the rhythm of the iambic pentameter, da-dum, da-dum, da-dum. He had a bottle of wine. He was a little excited about it, but he felt that everyone just about, except him, a handful of other directors, a handful of other actors, was speaking Shakespeare wrong. They were speaking Shakespeare wrong because when they came to the end of the 10-syllable da-dum, 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 mm-hmm. iambic pentameter line, they were not pausing to take a little breath, to give a little slight sensory break. Instead, they were going with a sort of naturalistic method of acting that you know we're taught is more sophisticated, which is to just keep running the words around to the next line, even if they don't end a sentence at the end of the line. Just keep going and going and act as if there were no line endings at all. And he felt it was important to emphasize the ending of the line. And why? Well, his reason was that in doing so, you gave each line its own aesthetic integrity. You made it like a little jewel box. By making it an enclosure, you allowed the reflections of the words to bounce off against each other, against the walls of the beginning and the end of the line. Or you made it into an enclosed echo chamber, you could say, where the sounds could bounce off the enclosed beginning and ending of the line. And he said that in doing so, you would be returning to what Shakespeare's intentions were, and you would be unleashing a power in those lines that was flattened out or lost if you just ran it around to the next line and didn't pause. Now,
Ron, let me take a pause here, and I want to return to that. I'm talking with Ron Rosenbaum, author of The Shakespeare Wars. He's helping us rethink the greatest works of human imagination, and you can join us by calling 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Now, let's return to that pause a little bit, because you write in your book, you say that this pause is, and I'm going to quote it here, "It's the foundation stone upon which director Peter Hall built the grand edifice, both physical and cultural, that is the Royal Shakespeare Company." And so you're arguing that this pause was really central to Hall's vision of Shakespeare. And this gets us a little bit to how Shakespeare originally sounded. Is this what Hall is arguing?
That was really what his intentions were, to strip away the incrustations of Victorian Shakespeare, which were like heavy scenery, you know, and some productions of Midsummer Night's Dreams, they would have actual forest with actual rabbits hopping around in it, to get back to the way Shakespeare was originally played on an almost bare stage with cinematic cutting. And if the stage is bare and you can cut, in a way, from Rome to Egypt in Antony and Cleopatra, for instance, without having to, like, move heavy scenery around. You know, you're there in Rome. You have Caesar speaking his words, and he leaves the stage, and Cleopatra comes on, and you're there in Egypt. It's cinematic cutting. He wanted to get back to the original way, and the foundation, the basic thing he wanted to get back to was the way Shakespearean verse was spoken. And just a little more on that pause, because I have to admit, you know, he was so impassioned about it, and yet I wasn't completely convinced until I took a Shakespearean verse-speaking class with an American director named Barry Adelstein, who had studied under Hall. And Adelstein said he, too, was a little puzzled by the pause until he came up with a way of thinking about it. He said, the pause at the end of the line, if you think of it as the moment when the actor or the character thinks up what the next line is going to be, it gives that next line an incredible momentum, a freshness, a sense of just the excitement of thinking up the new line. And obviously, the actor and character is not thinking up the line on the spot because he says the same line every time, every night. But nonetheless, if you do it as if you were thinking it up, it gives an energy and a momentum and a vibrancy and an excitement to it. And that is really when I say that Peter Hall built the whole Royal Shakespeare Company on a pause. It's a little hyperbolic, but in a way he built it on verse speaking, on how you speak Shakespeare's language. And he was saying, this is the way to do it. This is the way to unleash the spell of the language in a way that a florid, musical, oratorical emoting had not succeeded in doing.
Ron, I want to take a question from one of our callers. We have a caller from Champaign on line one. Please go ahead.
Okay, I have a question and a number of comments. First, I'm enjoying this a great deal, but what other books, I may have the author confused with someone else, but what other books has he written?
Have I written?
Yes.
My previous long nonfiction book was called Explaining Hitler, The Search for the Origin of His Evil. And then I also have about four or five collections of my journalism and essays. The most recent one is called The Secret Parts of Fortune, from Shakespeare.
Okay. I thought you were the author of Understanding or Explaining. That's a superb work.
Oh, so nice of you to say. Thank you.
Okay. And my comment is, you were talking about the line, which is that nothing is good or what?
Bad, but thinking makes it so.
Right. I've always disliked that line. It always reminds me of what? Albert Ellis, his rational cognitive therapy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. You know, Shakespeare was the founder of that in a way, if you believe Shakespeare himself added it. And on the other hand, you know, just to defend it slightly, it's something that Hamlet says, not necessarily Shakespeare says. So, you know, we don't have to necessarily feel that this is Shakespeare's wisdom. It's something, it may be Hamlet's way of handling his situation.
Ron, I want to follow up on the caller's question here. Before you spent 7 years writing this book on Shakespeare, you did take about 10 years to write Explaining Hitler, which is, as you said, you sought to explore the origins of the dictator and the hold he still has on us. And these seem like very disparate subjects. I mean, one is about a genius for creation and the other about a genius for destruction. Is there a link between these two books?
There is, in a way. And, I mean, one of the links is the fact that they're both geniuses in their own way, and one is the obverse side of human nature. But there's a more specific link, and it was this specific link that gave me the idea to do a Shakespeare book, and that link is the exceptionalist question. The exceptionalist question in Hitler studies is, was Hitler on the continuum of other evildoers, just on the far, far end, but still explainable by the same way we explain other evildoers, same methods, psychological, ideological, whatever, that we explain ourselves? Or was Hitler off the grid, beyond the continuum, in some realm of radical evil all his own? Similarly, it occurred to me, with Shakespeare, there's a similar question. Was he on the continuum of other great writers, just very, very great, maybe at the far end of the continuum? Or was he, in his own way, off the grid, beyond the continuum? Did he create some special realm of his own? That was like the first question, in a way, that got me into thinking about Shakespearean controversies and ultimately the Shakespeare Wars.
Ron, earlier when we were talking about the pause, we were talking about originalism and what Shakespeare was really like when it was performed, or a Shakespeare play, rather. One of the most fascinating chapters in the book is your visit with John Andrews, and he argues for reprinting the plays without updating the spelling of the words. And this sounds at first unimportant, but he demonstrates the richness that results. Can you give us some examples?
Yeah, it's fascinating. One of the most arcane and yet important of the Shakespeare Wars is the what's called the unmodernized spelling controversy. And John Andrews argues that one should at least try to experience Shakespeare on the page the way Shakespeare's own original readers experienced the same spelling. And in doing so, you find a greater multiplicity, a fluidity of meaning. And for instance, when Hamlet goes up to the battlements of Elsinore to look to meet his father's ghost, one of the first things he says, it's midnight, it's spooky up there, and he says, "The air bites shrewdly. It is a nipping and an eager air," meaning that's what it says in all the modernized spelling in all the Hamlet that we've read.
So that's
school.
Shrewdly.
Yes, okay. Shrewdly. But in the original quarto, it says the air bites shroudly, shroudly. And so suddenly there's this vision of the shroud, of death, of ghosts, of mortality, of hauntingness that enters into the text that wasn't there if you modernize shrewdly, if you modernize shroudly to shrewdly. Have I made that clear?
So we have this notion of a shroud that has something to do with death.
And, yes, exactly.
And we're back to the resonance that you talked about with the bottomlessness.
Yes, exactly. And and what John Andrews says is that, you know, people in Shakespeare's original audience could hear it both ways. Unmodernized spelling controversy is not so much about how it's spelled on the page, but in a way how it's heard, you know, and you can hear both shrewdly and shroudly. They were pronounced much closer to each other at the time. Another example is in the famous speech by Macbeth, which now is printed tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow, et cetera, et cetera. But it was originally printed to space morrow, morrow, and to space morrow. And so if you think about it, tomorrow bunched all together is a destination, but tomorrow is a kind of journey. And there's a subtle difference in it that I think, you know, has some real resonance. And there are any number of examples of that kind of added ambiguity that the original spelling gives. Because spelling during Shakespeare's time was much more fluid and unanchored. There were no dictionaries yet to say what was the right way of spelling. And so words could mean more things than one definite thing at the same time just through spelling. And so I resisted it for a long time. I thought, wow, we're really getting pedantic here. But in fact, I think your listeners should give themselves the experience of reading the unmodernized text. There are, for example, fairly inexpensive editions of the complete folio, the first printing of Shakespeare's complete works, which will do it for you.
Who publishes that?
Applause Books publishes, I think, the most inexpensive version. And there's also unmodernized spelling versions that Andrews prepared himself called the Everyman Edition. And you can find them on Amazon and things like that. So it's worth, you know, it's not the only way to read Shakespeare, but it's a favorite phrase of mine. It's defamiliarizing. You're not looking at what seems like the same old Shakespeare again. You're looking at a you're getting to experience Shakespeare in a slightly different, slightly more resonant way than you would have in the past.
Let's talk about reading the plays. A.C. Bradley, who was one of the greatest critics and interpreters of Shakespeare, actually said that he took no pleasure from seeing the plays on stage, but preferred to read them as novels. I mean, do you see merit in this? Would you recommend this to listeners as the way to appreciate the plays?
Unfortunately, I think that most stage productions of Shakespeare these days don't really do justice to it. There's this thing I say to people that if you go to a stage production of Shakespeare and you don't get it, it's not your fault, it's their fault. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I actually argue somewhat contrarianly, somewhat anachronistically, that you can get a greater jolt, a greater thrill from watching some Shakespeare on film, because you can see some of the great actors of the past century, Olivier, Gielgud, Ian McKellen, doing amazing Shakespeare on film at your video store, Shakespeare at the level you will almost never see from some company passing through town. And you know, it's interesting, during the course of writing this book, I would tell people I'm working on a book on Shakespeare, and people would sort of say shamefacedly to me, you know, I read Shakespeare in college, and I've been meaning to get back to it. Mm-hmm. What should I read first? And what I tell them is, don't read first. Go rent first. Go to your video store. Get Laurence Olivier's Richard III. Get Orson Welles' Chimes at Midnight, which is his compression of the two parts of Henry IV. Mm-hmm. Get those two films. Get Peter Brook's King Lear. And you will find yourself just riveted, thrilled by them. And you will then be driven back to reading the plays because you'll want to read them, not because you're doing something dutifully, because you've been told that Shakespeare is great. And you will also find that there's... when Shakespeare is done by great actors, as it is on these films, there's no problem with the clarity of the language. It comes across with just amazing brilliance and clarity. It's, you know, the problem with clarity of the language is with actors who haven't mastered how to speak it.
Now, let's look at how some others have read Shakespeare, some that you discuss in your book, Shakespeare Wars. The pop cultural critic Harold Bloom had a fascinating bestseller about Shakespeare. And I want to note before I ask about Bloom that you wrote this in your book, Bloom, 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 with question marks every time. Like the beating of a big bass drum, one can't help hearing it if you're writing a book about Shakespeare. And you add that one will hear approximately 1,000 times, "What do you think of Bloom?" Now, I'm going to ask a 1,001th question then. Bloom makes the very expansive claim that Shakespeare invented human nature, suggesting that before it we were some kind of unformed primitives before his plays. And what do you make of this very large claim?
Well, you know, I'm deeply conflicted about Bloom. I studied, I took Bloom's course at Yale, and I feel a little guilty criticizing him because I think I probably still owe him a paper, but... nonetheless, I think Bloom's claim that Shakespeare invented the human is ridiculous. I mean, can you name a single human emotion or faculty that did not exist before Shakespeare? I mean, Shakespeare may have invented Harold Bloom, but he did not invent the human. And that's not why Shakespeare is great. Bloom makes statements about Shakespeare that make him into a god and make Shakespeare all about big Bloomian themes rather than about the amazing brilliance of Shakespeare's language, which is, you know, really the heart of the matter to me. And so,
some anxiety of influence there on Bloom's part, I think.
Yes, that was the title of one of his previous books. On the one hand, I admire Bloom because for a long time he fought a lonely fight for a belief, the ability to believe in literary greatness and literary value when it was, and it still is, largely unfashionable in the academy to believe in literary greatness or literary value. But on the other hand, I feel his argument about the nature of that greatness is not a good argument, doesn't do justice to the greatness of Shakespeare.
Well, let's take a look at how you read one of the plays and in kind of our final moments here. One of your personal favorites is a play that I think is probably not familiar to most of our listeners, and I'm speaking of Troilus and Cressida. What appeals to you about this play? What charms you?
I would not use the word charm. I'm glad you brought it up, because Troilus and Cressida is, it's a brilliant play. It's an anti-war play set during the siege of Troy, based on Chaucer's Troilus and Cressida. But unlike Chaucer, Shakespeare, one thing he does in this play is lampoon, make fun of some of the great figures of Greek mythology. Achilles is a dolt. Helen of Troy is a slut. They're all, you know, all these figures that we're supposed to think of as demigods are just ridiculous, cretinous murderers. It's an anti-war play. It's a bitter, satirical satire on sexuality. It's Shakespeare at his sharpest and edgiest, So it's really it's a very modern play in a way. It's a play that it's been produced more and more since we're living through a period of wars, and it is a play that makes fun of the futility and the meaninglessness of war, and I think readers would enjoy it.
So, Ron, at the end of your book, you draw from the language, or better, I'd say, the silence of the Tempest, which is Shakespeare's last play, and you ask whether he's reached and recognized the limits of his own linguistic powers, and then, even more radically, you wonder if he reached and recognized the limits of language itself. You know, in what way does this sum up what you've learned about Shakespeare, or about your approach to Shakespeare?
Well, that was you've phrased the question very precisely, and you've also phrased precisely my own dilemma. You know, it's one of the Shakespeare wars that I find very hard to resolve. Did Shakespeare reach his own limits, or did he reach the limits of the possibility of language itself? I wish I could give you a definitive answer to that. It may be that I've reached the limits of my powers of discernment, but I think the limits of Shakespearean language and the limits of language itself are very close in a way. I think with Shakespeare, I guess because no one has surpassed him, perhaps someone will, and perhaps someone will show that the language has far greater resources than Shakespeare has shown us, and I'll be very eager to read that person.
Ron, we have reached the limits of our time here.
Okay.
Thanks for taking the time to chat.
Oh, I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
I'm Bill Hammack, and I've been talking with Ron Rosenbaum, author of The Shakespeare Wars, Clashing Scholars, Public Fiascos, Palace Coups.